Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about a third Bush war, not Iran, but Pakistan, with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's an award-winning investigative journalist and historian, the author of several books, including Richard Milhouse Nixon, The Rise of an American Politician, and his history of the United States policy and covert intervention in South Asia and the Middle East, entitled Shadows of the Eagle, will be published soon by Knopft, obviously covering some of the subjects. We'll also talk, of course, about the presidential debate, the first presidential debate. Then we'll turn to the economy and look at the economic turmoil that appears to have been exacerbated by John McCain's parachuting into the negotiations last week, threatening to put off the debate in order to help make a deal, which in fact was extended, at least the haggling was extended, with hollow offers on the part of the Republican House. Apparently they've all come to their senses. We'll be talking with Dr. Robert Pollan, who is the Political Economy Research Institute's founding co-director and professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And he'll also be joined by Dr. Michael Perlman, who is a professor of economics at Cal State University in Chico. He's the author of 25 highly regarded books on economics and his most recent book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity. So both those economists will be joining us to give us an update on where things stand. Apparently, the president and the secretary of the treasury were not exaggerating when they said that the entire global economy was hanging by a thread. But that didn't apparently prevent a lot of grandstanding in Washington. We'll also speak with a conservative legal scholar, Bruce Fine. We'll talk about our democracy in distress. I'm now speaking with Roger Morris, who, as I mentioned, served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's an award-winning investigative journalist and historian, and the author of several books, including Richard Milhouse Nixon, The Rise of an American Politician, his history of U.S. policy and covert intervention in South Asia and Middle East, entitled Shadows of the Eagle, will be published soon by Knopft. And clearly, we've got our plate full here in terms of foreign policy, Roger Morris, with a war in Iraq, which, of course, in this Karl Rovian sleight of hand, semantical sleight of hand, where they've said the surge is working, but nobody discusses whether or not the war is working. Admiral Mullen, just the other day, in testimony to the Congress, he's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said we are not winning in Afghanistan. And now it looks as though we could blunder into a third war, not so much in Iran, which has been threatened for some time, but with Pakistan.
Well, we certainly could, and all of this was highlighted, of course, Ian, with this presidential debate. I suppose if you were a remotely sentient observer of this process, nothing was unpredictable about that, but it was, after all, a tragic missed opportunity, I think, certainly on the part of Senator Obama, to educate the 57 or 60 million people we now think were watching this debate about these very issues you're talking about. I suffered a recurrent case of what I would call wince and cringe at moments in the debate about issues that Obama could have taken up, could have explained more lucidly, not least McCain's reference to torture. Torture, of course, is still going on under the vague gray area definitions of the Bush administration, aided and abetted by John McCain. The small discussion, and I mean small-minded discussion, over Georgia and Russia was another example of an oversimplification of a complicated and certainly two-sided international problem, which will be with us for a long time. How we relate to post-Soviet Russia. And not least, of course, Iraq, where Obama could have done something besides constantly agree with McCain or say that he was right, and could have pointed out that the surge is much less a matter of military strategy or even political change than it was the bribery of Sunni insurgents and a very short-term fix which stands to come apart in the near future. Now, that brings us, of course, back to your subject, which is their agreement again on Afghanistan and even on Pakistan. It was a depressing uniformity, a conformity of views there. Some Democratic critics, Katrina VandenHeuvel yesterday in the Nation, I see, have begun to point out that Obama may be the author here of a fatal consensus on staying in Iraq and on pursuing the war in Afghanistan, which stands, of course, to be a cemetery, really, in my view of his presidency. All this comes back to the history that you and I have talked about so very often. It comes back to what Obama early in the primary campaign called changing the mindset in foreign policy, but there was no evidence in that debate that any mindset had been changed or any new knowledge really introduced into the process. Both men are in the grip of all the old shibboleths and cliches of foreign affairs, not least because Obama, of course, is in the grip of the old foreign policy establishment in its new democratic form. So, yes, we do face awful perils and hazards on the Pakistan-Afghan border.
But, Roger, clearly it's always puzzled me why it is that George Bush's mistake in Iraq has always been the Democrats' problem. Why can't the Democrats turn it back and force the prosecutors of this war to explain their objectives and their success thus far? I'm using the word success ironically, but I'm always astounded as to why Bush's mistake has become their problem.
Well, it's a very old story, and in my view, it's the Democrats enthralled to and hostage to, really in mortal fear of this, what they perceive to be a national reaction on these matters. They perceive out there, even the country they think will vote for them, a chauvinistic, nationalistic, uninformed, undifferentiated public that doesn't want to lose a war, doesn't want to prosecute it, doesn't want to spend a great deal of the national treasure, doesn't want too many coffins coming home, but at the same time is fiercely parochial and proud, and doesn't want to, as McCain kept referring on Friday night, doesn't want to come home in defeat. It's very much this Democratic surrender to the way the Republicans, the conservatives, the know-nothing right, have defined foreign policy for the last 30 years, and even longer. Of course, this goes back to the old hardened categories of the Cold War.
Well, obviously, the debate, and you joined us on the national broadcast that I did with Sonali Kohutka just prior to and following the debate on Friday, the first debate, which, of course, we all know that John McCain was trying to postpone it in order to save the economy, but it turned out he was actually putting the economy in jeopardy and somewhat grandstanding. But that's a subject I guess we'll discuss with the two economists. But it was, to my mind, it was dull, and it certainly wasn't decisive. And I think the American people were ill served if they were hoping to see the new leader of the free world expose a vision of how the country will deal with its foreign policy challenges and its domestic crisis at home. In fact, it was, I thought, just almost like a schoolboy spat, echoing in terms of foreign policy, just petty tribalism, hollow patriotism, and ritual jingoism.
Oh, absolutely. The first 45 minutes, of course, were just a Washington family quarrel over earmarks. But, you know, Obama is better than this. The people around him ought to be better. But the missed opportunities there were absolutely legion, and the most significant, of course, was Afghanistan. This is not a war or a struggle, a challenge that's going to be met by three more brigades or by an escalation of the war, by an Afghan version of the surge. This has been a policy which was wrong from the very beginning. It's based on an ill-informed and ignorant view of the history of the place, of our involvement there. certainly Obama could have tagged the Bush administration, but then he would have had to have, in truth, said something about the Clinton and previous Democratic administrations as well, with responsibility for our policy in Pakistan. That state is as much a product of American policy, it's as much our making, as any state on the face of the planet. And if it is indeed a failed state, and in many respects it is, its black economy larger than its known one. If it is indeed a failed and corrupt and hopelessly stymied state, as McCain pointed out, that was very largely the product of its main patron in world affairs, the United States, over a very long period, a bipartisan tragedy and disaster which dates back to the 1950s, but. The opportunity there to educate the American public was lost completely. And, of course, what looms ahead of us is a very simplistic, conventional view of how to deal with the problem in Afghanistan, to continue our alliance with what is really, in essence, a collection of drug-running warlords and the very frail Karzai regime until someone eliminates him, and to continue to mollify and to vacillate with the Pakistanis as I think the civilian government there eventually totters and falls, and we're facing one more military dictator with whom, of course, we're always more comfortable in the end in any case.
Well, the bagman, Mr. 10%, the new president, the widower of Benazir Bhutto, who Condoleezza Rice shoehorned into the prime ministership with a deal that was struck in the Emirates in secret with Musharraf. Then, of course, after Rice had made this marriage of convenience between these two people who hated each other, and all of her sins were forgiven, and she goes back there. The first day she gets back there, she's almost blown up. 100 people die. Then she begs the White House and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice for protection, and she's hung out to dry. I mean, what I find most galling about the Bush foreign policy, and I think you can make a case that the McCain foreign policy will be even more reckless, which is really saying something. And, of course, a Palin foreign policy would be just off the charts. But the long and the short of it is, I cannot believe the blithe incompetence of these people who are stewards of our national security and how they just walk away from things as if they didn't happen.
Well, I do interviews from time to time with media in Europe, and they're fond of talking about Pakistan as a country ruled by its intelligence agency, the legendary ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence, and which is of course a state within a state. I think the problem we are talking about here is that American intelligence and certainly the American military presence in and around Pakistan, the Pakistan lobby and presence in the Pentagon, all of those are terribly powerful forces that tend to rule American policy there. The Department of State has very little to do with it. I think Condoleezza Rice is a captive of those harder line forces. I think this is one area where Dick Cheney is still very much in control of what American policy is, and there's absolutely no discussion either on the Hill or anywhere else, really in the media for that matter, Ian, of what the central issues are of how to get this back on the track that has any remote chance of stability in the long run. And meanwhile, of course, the Russians are indeed looming, and the Iranians are indeed there, right on the border. Afghanistan, as previous 19th century analysts called it, is indeed the cockpit of this part of the world, and it stands to be the single most important test of the Obama administration, and I think there's good indication that they've already failed it.
Well, it may be a perpetual fail state, and it certainly is the graveyard of empires in terms of the British and the Russians. But I guess the last time there was any real stability was, in fact, under Najibullah, and of course, Brzezinski and company were using the CIA to destabilize him and bring about the Soviet intervention, which happened. And then the consequence of that, of course, was our intervention to pay them back for Vietnam. We used
it was the irresistible temptation, yes, to bleed the Soviets in this place, which we ended up doing, of course, at the cost of 1.5 million Afghan lives. It's an enormous tragedy. I don't think it's hopeless. I think that Afghanistan is one of those places where money and resources and wise policy directed in the right way could make an enormous difference. But it will require the kind of political will and the kind of turning our back on old alliances and on old mistakes and the acknowledgement of those mistakes, which American foreign policy and the American political dialogue seems incapable of achieving. We could certainly turn Afghanistan around. We could give it a social democratic government of the kind that it needs, which respects its religious traditions, which addresses the fundamental issue which lies behind all of this, which is the grinding poverty and inequality of this multi-ethnic, multi-tribal state that has always been a patchwork and an uneasy alliance of all of these forces. But power has to be taken out of the hands of the drug mafias. It has to be taken out of the hands of the feudal warlords. The central government has to be given the resources and the democratic form to make it work. And but we're so uninformed in our policy there, and have been from the moment we began our punitive expedition there in the fall of 2001.
And do you believe that we're taking our frustrations for our own mistakes out on the Pakistanis? I mean, obviously, anti-Americanism inside Pakistan is so rife, and a lot of it's been exacerbated by Iraq, that perhaps the Pakistanis can't see the forest for the trees in terms of their fury at America, but their inability to recognize that the religious extremists within their own country are also a threat.
It was perfectly okay for the Pakistanis to support the Taliban and to even to give safe haven during the American invasion. You remember Cy Hirsch's wonderful article in The New Yorker, "The Getaway." It was perfectly okay as long as the Americans seemed to be winning in Afghanistan, and Karzai with his beautiful robes appeared at symbolic meetings and so on. Now the Taliban is resurgent, and it still is an instrument of Pakistani policy, and of course we're going to take it out on them. We move from sponsoring one set of oligarchs to sponsoring another in Pakistan. Now it happens to be the more or less Sindhi civilian oligarchs whom we're behind. That won't last long. I would predict that we're going to have a military savior before very long, again, in Pakistan, and an American policy will be with him, as it has been with every military dictator since the 1950s.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes here, Roger Morris, just returning to the debate the other night, and you graciously joined us on the national broadcast that I did with Sonali Kahatka prior to the debate and after. And you, of course, have served under a Democratic National Security Council with President Johnson and the Republican National Security Council under Richard Nixon, your boss being Henry Kissinger, of course, is the guru who's trying to give Sarah Palin a crash course in geopolitics.
Everybody's guru. I mean, you remember that Obama's saying, you know, I don't think
right. Why did this man who's got so much wrong, why is he so everybody's number one advisor?
You know, it's a wonderful line from Maureen Dowd, you may have seen, who said, you know, he was wrong 35 years ago, and it's only gotten worse since then.
I had a meeting with him about, I got two years, I think, before the Berlin Wall came down. And I told him that I thought that the Berlin Walls came down, and they thought I was completely insane.
No, Henry. One of the things that I've done in my book is to point out how much Henry is responsible for much of this. It's under Henry and under Nixon that the first American serious covert interventions in alliance with the Chinese and the old Shah of Iran began in Afghanistan. The real meddling that leads down this long, twisting path to the present. and it's an awful tragedy. Henry is totally unqualified to advise anybody on that part of the world. It was a graveyard and will be a graveyard of his reputation.
Right, and he sold out the poor Kurds just almost like on a whim, you know.
I have a scene in the book where he's when the insurgency is going on. This is in northern Iraq, of course, when we're backing the Shah and trying to harry Saddam Hussein, and he's bent over map tables in his office in the Department of State, directing military activities in northern Iraq. It would all be a joke. It would all be funny if it weren't so tragic in its sequel and its implications. But yes, he's become a guru because, of course, there's absolutely no one. The Democrats are peopled by pygmies here in foreign policy. There's no one of any stature. Obama's group of foreign policy advisors, my God, it was no anachronism left behind in that group. Madeleine Albright and Warren Christopher and almost every person who's been wrong about some significant aspect of foreign policy for the last 20 years.
Dick Holbrooke, yeah. Well, just in closing, though, I mean, you served under Democrats and Republicans, and then you became a Green Party supporter. And we made an effort the other night in our national broadcast to bring on independents, and we had Cynthia McKinney, the head of the Green Party. And of course, the Greens and are now competing with Ralph Nader, who's running an independent, and Bob Baer is a Libertarian, and Ron Paul, of course, could have run and probably did better than all of them. So what's happened to the third party, which we desperately need to revive our Tweedledum and Tweedledee democracy?
Well, I had a dear old friend who said, you must never judge a religion by the people who go to the church, and you must never judge parties by the people who represent them in national elections. What's happened, of course, is that third parties are automatically and lethally marginalized in American politics for a variety of reasons, legal and financial and ideological, all the rest. But there are no people of stature. You know, neither McKinney nor Nader nor any of these third-party people, certainly not Barr, none of these people reflect the very vibrant debate and very informed debate which is going on on both the conservative and the progressive side of American politics. And a lot of traditional conservatives, libertarians, are rethinking and reassessing America's role in the world. Antiwar.com, that site is full of imaginative and creative new thinking by people whose politics really are traditionally very much on the right, but they're meeting the progressives coming in the other direction on many of these issues of the empire and of post-Cold War policy. So there is hope. I don't mean to sound so desperately pessimistic here, but I do think we're in a great deal of trouble, and the Obama presidency will just be the beginning of a long battle here to try to get some sanity introduced back into policy.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles. Roger Morris, again, served on the senior staff of the National Security Councils under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, resigned over the invasion of Cambodia, the author of a forthcoming book, Shadow of the Eagle, which is the history of the covert and overt intervention in South Asia and the Middle East. I'm now speaking with Dr. Robert Pollan, who is the Political Economy Research Institute's founding co-director and professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And he is going to be joined here also by Dr. Michael Perlman, who's a professor of economics at Cal State University in Chico. Both of you gentlemen, of course, have, I imagine, watching this meltdown on Wall Street. And it's been extraordinary, though, to watch this theater that's been going on here with the conservatives beating their breasts, the recalcitrant Republican House in particular, beating their breasts with populist grandstanding, railing against the free market that they enabled, while it's the Liberal Democrats who are manning up to do the heavy lifting to help President Bush and the Secretary of the Treasury prevent the whole economy from collapsing before the Asian markets open on Monday.
We get the circuses without the bread.
Again, is that Robert Pollan speaking?
No, that's Michael.
Michael. And Robert, what's your feeling?
Well, you know, it is remarkable. The point is that the free market economics doesn't work. It never has worked. And it's only in moments like these that we recognize that free market economics lead to financial crises. And then, yes, the contradiction emerges that the the biggest supporters, the biggest proponents of free market capitalism, beg for socialism, beg for a bailout. They want free markets when they can privatize profits, but when losses are at hand, then they want socialism, and that's where we are right now.
And Dr. Michael Perlman, I've spoken to some economists over the weekend, and they've said that this situation really is dire, that they're not exaggerating, that there's no liquidity, that the entire short-term paper is just dried up.
I don't think that's necessarily true. It may be, it may not. That will have to come out later, depending upon what happens. What's going on, though, is that fear grips the thing, and you get overshooting of optimism, and you get overshooting of fear. So in all likelihood, if the government said, okay, you guys work this out, let the finance sector take some haircuts, take some losses, it would probably work out. The problem is, by putting in a rescue plan, what you're doing is you're taking a child and telling them no, but not doing anything about it, turning your back. And the next time, the excesses will become even more extreme. So the conservatives are right, some of the conservatives are right to warn about that. Not the House Republicans, but some are.
Well, Dr. Pollan, isn't it pretty clear that since the 70s, wages in the United States have been flat, and for the longest time, household income and productivity have tracked in parallel? In 2000, they diverged. Productivity went up and household income went down, which means that capital is the beneficiary of the new economy and labor is not. And this seems inexorable. So I think the only way that we've maintained a standard of living in this country commensurate with the rest of the democracies is that we've had cheap oil and cheap gas, and all bets are off there. And we've had credit, although credit itself, for over a decade now, the Fed's been lending out money to the banks at 2%. They've been charging it back to the American consumer at up to 20% with credit cards, leading to a $10 trillion credit card debt. How did everybody in this country get hosed so much, like compared to the rest of the world, in terms of real wages essentially made up for with this sleight of hand with credit?
Well, yeah, the real wage stagnation has gone on, as you said, Ian. It's gone on for basically a generation. The real wages today, the average real wage for a U.S. non-supervisory worker today is about 10% below what it was in 1972. That's over a period in which productivity doubled. So productivity has gone up. The pie has gotten twice as big as it was in 1972, but workers are getting 10% absolute less than they did in 72. So the money had to go somewhere, and it went to profits, and it went to Wall Street. And you're right, so the way that we've made up for the decline in the average living standard or the average wage is first by, you know, more people in the household working, adding hours of work, adding numbers of jobs. And then, as you said, the big story has been the rise of household debt. And the rise of household debt, a big part of that is credit card, and the other part is the mortgages. So it has been building towards a crisis for many years. There, of course, have been other bubbles in the last 20 years and other crises which are tied to financial deregulation. And financial deregulation coupled with money flowing up to the top to Wall Street is how we got the bubble economy.
And Dr. Michael Perlman, your most recent book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, From Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Depression, leaving aside, and we'll talk about it, obviously, whether there will be a depression. I'm astounded that nobody, and particularly Barack Obama, is pointing out this Robin Hood in reverse situation that was in many ways engineered by Phil Graham, the co-chair of McCain's campaign and his former chief economic advisor. What happened was that poor aspirants to the middle class, mostly minorities, were encouraged to buy mortgages, And so there was a massive transfer of wealth from the poor people in this country trying to get into the middle class to the rich on Wall Street, who just confiscated that wealth and then left this whole house of cards to crumble. And now, of course, the poor, overburdened taxpayer who pays a disproportionate share because Bush's tax cuts went to the top 2%, many of whom don't pay taxes at all. This is criminal.
I don't disagree with you at all. Now, one of the side points of this, because I agree with everything Bob says. In fact, it's much of the story of the book, was just what he was talking about. But if you look, the U.S. is becoming like a giant hedge fund, and the total corporate taxes, 41%, are in the financial sector. But, of course, that doesn't include all of the finance, because many of the industrial and retail companies also make money off finance. There is relatively little production going on. That is, most of the investment in the country is coming from not from profits, but from depreciation allowances. At the same time, you have very, very little investment that... You have corporations like Exxon that are devoting more money to buying their stocks back than they are to capital investment. Not just over depreciation allowance, but total capital investment. So you have a system which is actually bleeding itself to death, because you're not getting any investment. There's more and more debt, and ultimately, a system, even a financial system, requires production. And the U.S. has been neglecting that production to its own detriment.
Dr. Robert Pollan, just back on the political question, we mentioned earlier that the Republicans in the House were able to grandstand for the people back home, none of whom are happy about the idea of their tax dollars, $700 billion, going to bail out the profligacy and irresponsibility on Wall Street. That, of course, is obviously playing to the gallery there. But how come Obama and the Democrats can't make the point that I was just making, which is this is criminal. This is a Robin Hood in reverse, the stealing from the poor to help the rich who don't need it.
Well, I want to agree with you, but I also want to add one point. The Democrats are guilty, too. Financial deregulation was embraced with great enthusiasm under the Clinton administration. The people that are standing next to Obama now as symbols of fiscal probity and intelligent economic management, Robert Rubin and Lawrence Summers, who were his two last Treasury secretaries, they heartily went along with all the deregulation. Rubin himself, after he signed the death knell to the old regulatory system, Glass-Steagall, himself benefited from deregulation by taking a job at the merged Citigroup, which was a combined investment and commercial bank, which would not have been legal under the old regulatory laws. So that is certainly part of the story. The Democrats don't want to push too hard on this, because they are also exposed. Now, beyond that, we are in a really tight, difficult situation, and I completely agree with the people who are absolutely livid about the notion of this bailout. At the same time, if we allowed the free market to work itself out, I think there's a very high probability that we would face a extremely severe crisis, and it would affect innocent people. It would affect a lot of people, hundreds of millions of people who have nothing whatsoever to do with Wall Street. I don't know that it necessarily will happen. I agree with Michael on that. But the odds are high enough that I don't think we can take that risk. So therefore, I think there does need to be some kind of bailout. But bailout for what? Who's getting bailed out? We need to maintain the stability of the financial system, but we need to toss the crooks out, and we need to re-regulate Wall Street. That has to be the formula, and we haven't gotten there yet.
Well, I just feel, though, that to some extent, we seem to be sleepwalking through history. Just on Thursday night, we had the biggest bank failure in history, and it went largely unnoticed because of John McCain's antics, rushing off to Washington and wanting to delay the debate, etc. And then just a few days ago, the House, by an overwhelming majority, passed a $612 billion defense budget, which, as we all know, is a complete fraud because much of the defense budget is scattered throughout the other agencies to make it look smaller. And you've got to add to that to $612 billion, $50 billion for Homeland Security, $20 billion for the nuclear arsenal with the DOE, $10 billion to the Coast Guard through transportation, and then $125 billion for security assistance that's sprinkled out through state. And then you've got Veterans Affairs, $91 billion. And the supplementals that have been off the books for Iraq and Afghanistan. So you're over $1 trillion there. So $1 trillion are going out the window as we speak to Wall Street. Another $1 trillion is being pledged to defense. I mean, it reminds me of Everett Dirksen's old. You know, a billion here, a billion there. Sooner or later,
it'd be real money. Right?
Yeah, but now it's a trillion here, a trillion there. I mean,
that's it. So, Michael, what I was thinking when you were saying that.
I'm reminded about Mark Twain's old statement about he said, "Beautiful credit." He said, 2 years ago, I wasn't worth 2 cents. Now I owe $10 million." And like Bob said, both parties are wrong. Also, you forgot the Agriculture Department, which is dealing with biohazards and the like.
Sure. Well, isn't that a form of right-wing welfare? Doesn't that keep the red states voting Republican?
Of course it is. I mean, but the problem, there's a political problem, and I'm totally in agreement with you on that. But I would say you have to get back to that the problem of production. That is, you bail the financial companies out. What assurance do we have that anything useful will be done with that money? There is a way. If I were looking at the bailout, what I would think about is you look at how much the securities are worth on the market, and you do get a measure of that because they have a market for insurance on the securities. And you could use that to value the securities. I'm sure that's something that the Treasury Department will not do. And you make these companies take serious losses. The idea that you have to make them whole is absolutely ridiculous. I agree with Bob that there is a chance that something very, very bad might happen. But to rush into this, to hold the whole country hostage, and this is the strategy that the Bushes have used all along, as they did with the bill that you're talking about. You know, if the government will shut down if you don't give us all these goodies and allow us to drill offshore and yada, yada, yada. But there has to be something done to restructure the economy to make it more productive. And by productive, I mean actually producing stuff.
And Dr. Pollan, I mean, clearly, there is a crisis in American capitalism, which Dr. Perlman's talking about, which is that we no longer produce. And in fact, 60 Minutes did a Valentine the other day to a Wall Street speculator, Carl Icahn. And these people just sit at desks and make bets on computers and do nothing to generate jobs and the general welfare of the country. So why are we celebrating speculators? Is that what's happened? That capitalism has gone from the rubber barons to the speculators?
Well, we've had a generation in which that has certainly been the pervasive idea that these are the guys that are making the most money. I mean, you know, not just far-left people, but conservative, moderate, liberal people have been saying for a long time, as Michael said, that, you know, all the students from the Ivy League schools, they all want to be investment bankers, and you know, they make three times the amount of money that their professors do within a year and a half. I have a very short article in the current issue of The Nation about the bailout in which I say, look, we can debate the details of the bailout, but the main thing is that we have to have this trade-off in which we tax speculators. That's number one. We have a speculation tax. We have a limits on how much you can put into speculation and, unless you're holding cash. So they're called asset reserve requirements. We force those through. And third, we have subsidies for, as Michael's saying, for productive investments, like investments in green technologies, which is going to create millions of jobs. We have this massive productive project in front of us, which is to build a clean energy economy. We have to do that. So let's the trillions of dollars that are funneled into Wall Street, let's create an entirely different financial structure that channels that money into green investments, which also is a massive domestic jobs program.
Well, I thought the money was largely going in to a bottomless pit because nobody knows exactly what the value of this paper that they're buying is. I haven't noticed anywhere except for the entrepreneur T. Boone Pickens that anybody's interested in doing anything about our dependence on foreign oil, which we're constantly reminded of, and the need to deal with global warming. It seems to me, and of course we know that Pickens's whole project is rather self-serving. Here in California, he's actually paid for a proposition which he has on the ballot, which is going to require the state of California to build all the infrastructure for his ambitions to sell natural gas.
Also, you can mention that Pickens' talk about energy in Texas is largely about water, that he's using the right-of-way for the energy to get a right-of-way for delivering water to the big cities and to charge terrible, terrible prices. It's a total ripoff, but we shouldn't be surprised.
Well, at least the guy's at least saying something interesting and stimulating a debate. I mean, I'm saying this, that in the absence of any political leadership, it takes a billionaire, I guess.
Well, I think that, we have reached a crisis, and there's going to be very serious discussions taking place. There's, the level of anger is, of course, palpable, and we're going to have a new president, hopefully Obama, and that, not that Obama himself is going to be the one leading the charge, but the moment is here for a transitional program toward a green and a social justice agenda.
Well, I thank you both for joining us, Dr. Michael Perlman and Dr. Robert Pollan. Thank you, gentlemen, both.
Thank you.
I'm now speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer, formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration. He was General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law. Mr. Fine will be speaking at a forum entitled Democracy in Distress, Addressing the Legacy of Abuse of Power at the Museum of Contemporary Art in downtown Los Angeles on October the 1st at 7 o'clock. That's Wednesday, I believe. He has a forthcoming new book entitled Constitutional Peril. And since recently we observed the 7th anniversary of 9/11, Bruce Fine, one of the things that our president has said is that those who attacked us on 9/11 hate us for who we are, not because of what we do. So if they hate our freedoms, how come we retaliated against them by attacking our own freedom?
Well, you're right. We come to mirror the enemy. And moreover, the issue is not whether they attacked us and what the particular motivation is in terms of our own constitutional liberties and dispensation. The question is, how do we respond in a way that's consistent with the constitutional allocation of power and consistent with the understanding of war? I always thought it was wrong to label the danger created by Osama, Al-Qaeda as a war because it has very, very profound and alarming consequences. First, it means the war is never ending. There is no benchmark that says when the level of terrorism threat falls below X, the war is over. And, of course, politically, no president will ever stand up and say the risk of international terrorism is zero. So for the first time in the history of our country or in the history of the world, we have by definition a permanent war with permanent war powers. The second alarming feature is that under the idea that we are at war with a tactic that has no geographical contours or demarcations, it means all of the world is a battlefield. You and I are standing on a battlefield in President George Bush's mind, which means he can employ military force, impose military law anywhere he wants. All of our liberties and rights are now at President Bush's dispensation. We no longer have the unalienable rights that were enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. These are very, very alarming elements. A third thing that has happened since 9/11 is the final capitulation by Congress, in the media, the American people, to the idea that the president has the authority under the Constitution unilaterally to decide on war and peace. That is perhaps one of the most flagrant usurpations in the history of the United States Constitution. The founding fathers were uniform in insisting that only Congress had the authority to initiate warfare because the executive has a conflict of interest. The executive during wartime gets the fame, the remembrance, the handing out of the contracts, the promotions, the secrecy that embellishes and aggrandizes executive power. And every founding father, including those most ardent in favor of a strong executive like Alexander Hamilton, insisted that unlike the King of England, then King George III, no president would have the authority to initiate warfare. Now we've come to the conclusion that any president can initiate warfare. The debates between McCain and Obama are, well, who can initiate? Can you initiate? Will you initiate war in Iran? It isn't, war and peace isn't even an issue in a congressional campaign, which was, turns the Constitution on its head.
But hasn't the barn door been open for some time and the horse way down the paddock? I mean, you've got to go back to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. We haven't really, I suppose George Herbert Walker Bush did at least bring a vote about going to war against Saddam in the first Gulf War, but that was largely for political reasons, wasn't it?
Well, that's right. I don't want to deny that this is certainly not simply a Bush-Cheney phenomenon, this usurpation. And you're absolutely right. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution had Congress basically delegating its power to authorize warfare to Johnson, saying whatever President Johnson thinks is appropriate, he can initiate war. And that's what Congress did. Again, unconstitutionally delegate the power to initiate war in the Iraq case, where Congress in 2002 said if President Bush thinks he wants to initiate war against Iraq, he can. And again, what makes that so dangerous is it puts us really in permanent warfare. And it takes out of the country the one body that does not have a conflict of interest, that would not have an incentive to warp and deform and exaggerate danger in order for them to get kudos, secrecy, appointments, and money to spend. That's what the executive gets. And every founding father worried that if the United States was to fall into oppression and tyranny, it would be because of an inflated danger from abroad that was concocted by a president. And they didn't even want George Washington, as impeccable as character was, deciding on war and peace. And we see the consequences of the folly of letting the president decide these matters. Since 9/11, we've spent about $700-800 billion, probably after next year close to $1 trillion, on these wars, international terrorism, the occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq. And what we have gotten is a situation where we've made Iran stronger than ever before, has done nothing to blunt their nuclear ambitions. We've created more enemies than we've killed because of all of the civilian casualties that are inescapable in warfare. Most recently, we've seen it in Afghanistan. We create resentments abroad because we have a double standard. Namely, we can invade and encroach on your sovereignty if we think you have a terrorist there, but if you put a single foot on our territory without our permission, you are a criminal and we will destroy you. So we've made ourselves less safe and less free in spending $1 trillion. We should be spending defense on real defense, which is spy systems, defenses that can operate in retaliation if anyone would dare to attack us. We've forgotten really the mission of the Constitution and of our country that spelled out very clearly in the preamble, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. That means not thinking that we need and have an obligation, moral or otherwise, to try to make democracy the uniform system of the entire world. We, at the outset, understood the importance of our example in encouraging other countries to emulate a Republican form of government and individual freedoms, but not through force. We would not be like Robespierre, trying to cram virtue down other people's throats if they wouldn't be good like we wanted them to. And the consequence is a bloated executive that more and more approaches executive despotism, and we have become almost the country that we fought against in 1776 for our independence, namely a country that is an empire rather than a republic, where the executive dominates all decision-making of any importance, and secrecy is the rule, not the exception, and self-government is a mockery because no people can govern themselves if they don't know what their government is doing to them.
And Bruce Fine, we've seen the erosion of or the abdication of Congress's power and oversight through the Cold War, of course, the excuse being that Armageddon was only 30 minutes away and the red button was in the hands of the executive. But it's gotten so exponentially worse since 9/11, and we've had these peculiar unitary executive theories that Addington and the vice president have come forth with. The vice president himself is above the law, in effect. We don't even know whether he's a part of which branch of government. All of these quaint but inherently scary notions. And I'm wondering whether the problem lies, and certainly it appears, that the fact that we've just appointed the last two justices to the Supreme Court are both presidential lawyers. Why did the Congress so blithely put these men on the court when it was pretty clear? I mean, and if you've watched the Alito's rulings, I don't think there's any limit to his belief in governmental power.
Well, you're asking, you know, why was Congress so supine and effete? What did they do with Michael Mukasey, the Attorney General? I was up there telling the Democrats, how can you let this guy go through if he says I'm agnostic on whether waterboarding is torture? And they went and voted the Attorney General, who's even more blatant than the nominees that you identify in Alito and Roberts in believing in executive branch supremacy. And it's not only confirming appointments, they don't even attempt to exert their power of the purse to try to restrain the president. I've gone up there and I've drafted a half a dozen bills, say, this is how you can end this abuse. For instance, President Bush's claim that he can spy without warrants on us whenever he waives national security in contravention of a federal criminal prohibition and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I say, all you do is say no monies of the United States can be expended to gather foreign intelligence against a U.S. citizen in contravention of what's known as FISA. They won't do it. Because these members of Congress are loyal to their party. They're not loyal to the Constitution. They're not loyal to their oath of office. And one of the reasons why the Democrats have been so, I hardly have a word for it, so weak and cowardly on these separation of powers issues is because they are complicit. Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, the two highest Democratic members of Congress, knew about the waterboarding, they knew about the illegal surveillances, and they said and did nothing, and they worried they would be embarrassed if they attempted to force full disclosure of all the Bush administration abuses. But it's the Congress that has let Bush and Cheney get away with these abuses. It's because the abuses, unlike Nixon, have not been secret. They've been open and notorious. The signing statements, the committee that I served on for the ABA, criticizing the president for usurping legislative powers. That's open and notorious. His claims to be the sole decision-maker on any national security matters, those are open and notorious. The torture memos, open and notorious. Nothing happens. Nothing happens. I was testifying for the House Judiciary Committee a couple of months ago. It's called Limitations on Executive Power. I said, well, this is silly. The executive has no power unless we, the people, give it to him. And we need to be able to talk about impeachment in a serious way. But there isn't any response up there. It's like members crave the option of shuttling responsibility for war, peace, and decisions to the president so they can go back and claim that they had a few earmarks for their constituents and get reelected. It's a failure of will, and it's combined with a failure of will in the American people. These members are not getting emails, they're not getting letters, they're not getting telegrams complaining that they are doing nothing to oversee and check these executive abuses. This is in contrast during my baptism in Washington, which was Watergate. and the Nixon's celebrated Saturday night massacre, where the attorney general and the deputy attorney general resigned because they wouldn't fire the special prosecutor. And then there are 450,000 telegrams that came in within 24 hours saying Nixon needs to be impeached unless we have this investigation go forward. And when John Dean was testifying at the Senate Watergate Committee, the entire country was riveted. They were worried that they had a president who said, if I do it, it's not illegal. It must be legal because I can authorize breaking and entering. Today you have no public awakening, no public concern or consternation about these abuses of executive power. And Congress really is a weather vane on this score. They're reflecting what we are willing to let Bush and Cheney get away with. Because I underscore, the violations are open and notorious in the public record. Most recently it was revealed that, in terms of impeachable offenses, that then House Speaker, super conservative Dick Armey, was lied to twice. Right. By Dick Cheney to get him to flip his vote on Iraq.
I agree. I had the author of that book, Angler, on, I think it was last week, Bruce Fine.
Yeah, this is,
every week I talk to somebody who brings up more of these outrages. I thank you so much for joining us. I wish we had more time, and I'd like to do a rain check with you if I can.
Well, thank you, and I urge everyone to read my book. It amplifies in great details and shows that we are in the state of the Roman Empire, as was crumbled, the worst crimes committed by few, dared by more, but tolerated by all, and we need to change that. Thank you.
And the book, of course, Constitutional Peril. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. Special thanks to Alan Minsky.